Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, it's that time of year when you want to have a nice stack of books on your nightstand or reading table so that you can hide from the world and the weather and escape into a good book with a cup of cocoa. And today we're kicking off the season with someone who needs little introduction, Lisa Unger. She's a returning guest to Conversations Live, and her new book is called Confessions on the 745. Lisa's known as a master of character development and psychological suspense, and last time we talked about how we're both fascinated in the human psyche, what drives people to do the things they do. Today, we explore some of the research she did for Confessions on the 745. We discuss what makes a good con artist, why and how people lie, and why we often don't realize we're being conned until it's too late. Lisa also shares tips on how she stays creative in these chaotic times and much more. So let me tell you a little bit about Lisa. She's the New York Times and internationally best-selling author of 18 novels. She has millions of readers worldwide, and her books are published in 26 languages. She's widely regarded as a master of suspense, and her critically acclaimed books have been voted Best of the Year or Top Picks by The Today Show, Good Morning America, Entertainment Weekly, Amazon, IndieBound, and many others. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, and Travel and Leisure. And as I said, she's joining us today to talk about her latest book. It's hot off the press. Confessions on the 745. And here's my guest, Lisa Unger. Well, Lisa Unger, welcome back. Welcome back. It's been close to 2 years, I think, since we last talked, right before the 2018 midterms. And here we are again.
Thank you for having me again. I'm thrilled to be talking to you.
Well, the book is called Confessions on the 745. Of course, we're talking about a train here. And I want to just dive straight into the book because so many questions to talk to you about. We've only talked once before, but I know the kind of things that you're really interested in, and I want to get to some of those later on in the conversation. But I never want to give away too much. Don't want to give away any spoilers, so I kind of stick to the book jacket here. But your protagonist, Selena Murphy, is commuting home from her job in the city when the train stalls on the tracks. She strikes up a conversation with a beautiful stranger in the next seat, and the woman introduces herself as Martha and confesses she's been stuck in an affair with her boss, which then leads Selena to confess that she suspects her husband of sleeping with the nanny. And of course, she's very embarrassed about that after the fact, but because she's never going to meet this woman again. And days later, that nanny disappears and life is never as it was before. So talk to us a little bit about what you'd like to fill in on that.
Yeah, so the story is kind of very loosely based on the Patricia Highsmith novel, Strangers on a Train. And even though the book itself doesn't really have anything to do with the plot of that book, it was really sort of that that moment that I was most interested in, like this moment when two strangers meet, in under any circumstance, and how all the events of their lives, whatever those events were, led them to both be in the same place at the same time. And what type of magic or alchemy can there be in that moment, right? And so that was sort of the spark or the sort of the germ for the book that, really had me fascinated and drove me through the narrative. But of course, I don't really believe in chance or coincidence, and I think that no matter where a story starts, it started long before. So I'm also interested in that element of it, and that's also woven into the fabric of Confessions.
Yes, and it's about lives, it's about lies, it's about deceit. And as often in your books, about how we create this really fragile, really delicate facade around our lives. You know, we think this is our life, but if we look a little bit more deeply, there are big fractures there that we haven't even seen. And of course, there are in this story too, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that I sort of touch on in the book, and which I think we can all kind of relate to, is that, you know, we have these, you know, not just images that we project, like, sort of from our own selves and in our conversations, but we have these, like, sort of lives that we project in these very, you know, sort of filtered and curated versions of ourselves online, and how everything can look very, you know, on the surface, very perfect and beautiful, and that actually life is what's lived in between the moments that we post online. And so that's another layer of confessions as well. What you see on the surface is very rarely what exists beneath.
Yes. So tell listeners a little bit about the character Selena Murphy. She has a great job, and she's seemingly doing well and seemingly has this perfect setup, but it's not all it seems.
No, she's a young kind of working mom, and so she's in that space that, you know, sort of so many of us are, where we have a, like, sort of a big job and, you know, kids, and, you know, we're kind of pulled in a million different directions all the time. And she's been in this, you know, long marriage with her husband, and, you know, it's not perfect. It's, you know, it's definitely got its flaws, but she thinks it's good enough. And then it's revealed to her that, you know, there are bigger problems than she ever imagined. And so when she does meet that sort of stranger on the train, she's very vulnerable. She, you know, has her perfect life, you know, has this huge fissure in it. And beyond that, you know, she sort of comes from, you know, not trauma necessarily, but, you know, sort of the darkness of her parents' own terrible marriage. And she kind of carries that with her. And so there are a lot of layers to Selena that may not be immediately apparent on the surface, and which make her kind of vulnerable in that moment, you know, to somebody like Martha.
Right, right. And her husband, Graham, he's one of those guys I just want to slap.
At the very least.
I mean, how did you develop him? And obviously you felt the same, like you wanted to slap him too, I'm guessing.
You know, I always try to approach my characters, you know, sort of even the most twisted and deranged among them with compassion. You know, I try to understand their layers, and certainly Graham has a lot of layers, and even there might be many more layers to him than even made it onto the page, or, you know, there's actually quite a bit of Graham on the cutting room floor. A lot of time I spent trying to understand his character and who he is and what his, you know, what is that, you know, that core motivation, and how is he so able to present oneself to his wife and his family and be another person altogether with a, you know, with lots of layers that, you know, Selena doesn't, she suspects, but she's sort of willfully incurious, I think, to a certain degree. She knows that they're problems. She just hasn't wanted to look at them too deep. But, you know, I do think that, you know, there's always a fine line, you know, with your characters. You know, I never really see anybody as being all good or anybody as being all bad. I always see the various shades of who they are and what made them who they are. And I think that that's, you know, something that I do try to explore quite a bit in my fiction, is just that they're, you know, even the worst person thinks that he's the good guy. And there are reasons for that. And to explore that is important to me.
Right, and it also makes the characters much more believable, because nobody, you know, in very rare circumstances is somebody all dislikable. You know, they usually have some redeeming qualities there. And vice versa, with people who, you know, are good, there's usually some kind of thing there that's irritating or not quite as it seems.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the key, too, to the sort of authenticity of character, which is so critical to, you know, good fiction, is that, you know, you can really see all of those different layers, and nobody is ever, like, sort of a caricature. You know, most people make, you know, good, you know, some people make good choices most of the time, and some people make bad choices most of the time, and most of us make, you know, good and bad choices, you know, all the time. So we're just sort of, you know, we're all kind of very layered and textured, and, you know, the lots of sides to us. And so I feel the same should be true of my characters.
Yeah. Well, we talked last time quite a bit about how we both enjoy. I'm fascinated by people and why they do what they do and what drives them to keep doing it, even when they don't necessarily get great results from it. But and we talked about the human psyche and how that informs a lot of your work. And I know that when you develop characters in your book, you're basing some of those traits on psychological research versus what we'd call popular usage of terms like narcissist and sociopath and stuff. And you reference a book in the acknowledgements called The Confidence Game by Maria Konnikova. Yeah, Konnikova. So tell us a little bit about what did you take away from that book on con artists and how you use that in this book?
Well, you know, I had this kind of idea kicking around in my head for a while, and I'm not even sure where I originally heard it, but it was the idea that you can't con an honest man. And I thought, you know, when I heard that, you know, it has sort of the ring of truth to it, but it just seemed a little bit overly simplistic. And so I found myself kind of turning it over and thinking about it. And I even brought it up in a green room with a couple of other mystery writers before a panel that we were all on together. And, you know, one of the other authors I was speaking with, she was like, well, I don't know, you know, that kind of sounds like victim blaming to me. And I thought, yeah, you know, that's fair. That sounds true, too. So it was like, you know, kind of this internal thing that goes, this happens to me a lot with a lot of different topics. And so I wound up doing some research. And one of the books I read was The Confidence Game by Maria Konnikova. And it's a very, very, you know, smart, layered, entertaining exploration of the psychology of the con artist. And not just the psychology of the con artist, but the psychology of the conned. And it became clear to me that maybe it's not so much that you can't con an honest man, but that perhaps you can't as easily con somebody who doesn't want something.
Right.
And we all want something.
Right.
And the con artist is a particular type of, you know, personality pathology who is very good at discovering what it is you want, and he might know it better than you even know it yourself. And this is why so many very intelligent people, most of us feel like, oh, I can never fall for any, you know, any con or any scam. I'm way too savvy for that. But in fact, super intelligent people fall for the most simple cons, you know, with surprising frequency. And I was just very interested in that, like how, you know, just it's almost that, like the con is, it's not a smash or a grab, it's not a robbery, it's like a dance. You know, you might be given something that you want, and then once you've done that, or given something that you want, and then eventually something gets taken from you, but it's almost as though you give it. So it's just kind of an interesting, it's an interesting merging of these two psychologies, the con artist and the person who is falling for the scam or the mark.
Right, right.
As it were.
One of the people who's fascinated me over the years, and I've watched a lot on this particular person, is Christian Gerhardsreiter. He was a German guy who posed for years. I mean, he posed as many different characters over the years, but for years he posed as one of the Rothschilds and lived in New York. He married an extremely smart woman, had a kid with her. His wife was a big consultant with McKinsey. He mixed in high society in New York for years. Everybody was conned by him. When he finally ends up in prison and is interviewed by a BBC documentary filmmaker, I mean, he basically said that. He said, you never look at a person as a relationship. They're always a mark. And what's the one thing that allows him to con people? And he said, it's always the same thing. Vanity, vanity, vanity.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much the same thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stuff.
And and it's so amazing to me how many times you hear that story in a different form.
Yes.
Right? Like, how many times people get away with, like, you know, journalists, you know, who are plagiarizing, or, you know, authors who are pretending to be somebody that they're not, or, you know, just constant, you know, sort of people in the news at this type of, you know, like, a Bernie Madoff type figure, where, you know, like, people just thought he was, you know, the most amazing man for so many years, and turns out, you know, just a criminal. And it's such an amazing thing to hear this same story over and over again, and you think, how can these really, really intelligent people fall for this? And I think that is a very common reason why. It's vanity, and then how do they get away with it? A lot of times, when people are scammed, they don't report it, or they don't say it, for a lot of reasons. First of all, because in some ways they can't quite believe it themselves.
Right.
Right. Right? And they can't quite believe that they have been so wrong. And then for the victim of a scam or a con, there's a ton of shame. Like, people are very ashamed that they fell for it. And so they just don't report their losses or what's happened to them or whatever to the police or somebody who might be able to help, because they just feel so ashamed. How could I have fallen for this?
Right, right. It's fascinating stuff. One of the other people you mentioned in the acknowledgements is Pam Amaya, who's famous for her work on lie spotting and telling when somebody's lying. What did you discover about that, and how and why people lie? Because there are mixed theories out there. Some people say this is not true. I was watching a guy from the FBI who said, yeah, we like to think it's true, but it's really not. But then it seems popular consensus is that there are tells. There definitely are tells, I think. But,
well, there was, you know, before lie spotting, there was a book that I read called What Everybody Is Saying. And the author's last name is Navarro, and he's a former FBI interrogator. I think I'm getting that right. It's been a while since I've read the book. And he, you know, he talked about the importance of establishing a base, right?
Yes.
So that you can, in interviewing, start to understand the tells of this person. So it's not like everybody who blinks too much is telling a lie, or everybody who looks up and to the right is telling a lie, or everybody who clears his throat. Like, that's not true, right? Like, you can't determine whether somebody is lying from just those, you know, sort of physical tells that we all kind of think we know about, right?
Yes.
But
yeah.
If somebody is usually very calm, and then all of a sudden they're, you know, speaking very fast, or if somebody is often speaking very fast, then all of a sudden slowing down, then you can kind of tell there's something going on. It may not necessarily be that they're lying. It may be that they're uncomfortable for some reason. And so that's kind of like, you know, like you say, like, some people think it's not true and some people think it is true. I think that's probably a more appropriate way of looking at it. You know, there are all these things that people do when they're uncomfortable, you know, these limbic responses of the brain, like things that they're not controlling, like a tapping foot, or men when they're stressed out, they'll rub the tops of their legs, or they might rub at the crown of their head, because there's like a lot of nerve endings in those places in the body, and so it's a self-comforting gesture. So there are always sort of kinds of things like that that you could maybe look at to say, maybe not that this person is lying, but that they're uncomfortable. So that's the kind of tell. And, you know, in lie spotting, one of the things I found super interesting was that, you know, she just, you know, one of her basic premises is that, you know, people just lie all the time. And they lie for all kinds of reasons. And some of them are not even, you know, not even bad reasons. And sometimes they're not even aware necessarily that they're lying or confabulating. You might lie just, you know, not to hurt somebody's feelings, or you might just say, oh, you look great, even if you're subconsciously thinking that your friend looks really tired or whatever. You know, like, you just say things to comfort people, to put people at ease, to not hurt their feelings, whatever. So it may not even be like some nefarious intention that you have to lie It's just that there's like a, you know, it's almost like a reflex to try to, you know, if you're the type of a pleaser, you might just try to put people at ease, kind of a thing.
Right, right.
So there's all these different layers of, like, we always think of, you know, lying and the liar, like, this is like the worst thing you can be, right? But in some sense, we all do it, you know, almost like hiccuping. you can't even control yourself.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see, you know, to see that and then to explore that in fiction and, you know, and just in life too, you know, just kind of once you have that knowledge, you find yourself very much more so aware of people's physical tells.
Yes, yes. And those lovely micro expressions, which...
micro expressions, my favorite.
always a great thing to... Always a great and shocking thing to catch, if you catch one.
Yeah, and I think and that's such an interesting thing too, micro expressions, because it's like, you know, they really are like these tiny, tiny little movements of the muscles in the face that, you know, again, not controllable. Like, it's the limbic response of the brain. And I think it's funny that, you know, we may be aware of those micro expressions in others without being intellectually aware
of
them. We do a lot of picking up of those cues, even if we don't know. Like, yeah, this person doesn't like me. She was nice to me. She didn't say anything that was mean, but I can tell that she didn't like me. And usually it's, you know, because you picked up on something, you know, in the face, in the body language, in the energy. It may or may not be true, but... You've picked up on something that has given you that cue, even though intellectually you're not aware of it. And I think it's such an interesting thing to be thinking about too in this moment, like, you know, where so many of us are on Zoom and on teleconferencing and stuff like that, because like that ability that we have to like read other people's micro expressions and stuff like that has been greatly diminished by, you know, these Zoom interfaces, and it leads to a particular kind of fatigue for the brain.
Yes, I've been reading a lot of articles about that, Zoom fatigue.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
It's so interesting because your brain just goes into overdrive.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just like trying to figure out, like, what is this person thinking? How are they feeling? Like, what does this interaction mean, right? Like, your poor brain is not evolved to deal with any of this stuff, right? And so it's like so tired at the end of the day because you're like, it's just kind of like, I couldn't figure any of that out.
Yes, I'm all zoomed out.
Yeah, exactly.
So as an author, as a writer, I know that your primary goal, I've heard you say before, is to be a better writer every day. You say that's what drives you. When you get up in the morning, you have this drive to be a better writer every day. So we last talked 2 years ago. How do you think you've become a better writer since that time, Lisa?
I don't know. I keep trying. Today I'm one kind of writer. Tomorrow I'll be even better. I do. It is definitely my primary goal. I do believe that every day you can sit down at your computer and be a better writer than you were. And I think that that's just a matter of practicing your craft. You know, the more you do something, the better at it you become, hopefully, especially if you kind of remain in that beginner's mind where you always think, you know, I'm as good as I can be today. I'm going to be better tomorrow. I think that, you know, for me, that's a joyful feeling. That's like an excited feeling. It's not necessarily a pressure or something that I'm, you know, that I'm weighted under. But, you know, I think that, you know, just continuously trying to dig deeper into character, you know, continuously trying to, you know, say the most with the least amount of words, you know, to be precise in my language, to, you know, continuously sort of dive into story and create, you know, an authentic story world for my readers. These are the things that I work on and hope for with every book, hoping that every book is better than the one that came before it.
Right. And do you find that, do you have a favorite type of scene to write, or does it depend with each book and the characters involved?
Well, it really does depend on each book and the characters, but, you know, my favorite writing is always the internal sort of character conversation or monologue, like not necessarily monologue, but the inner voice of character, exploring those layers of character. And that's always my favorite type of writing. I love writing sort of any scene that's like exciting me. So that's, you know, that's really scene by scene, book by book. But, you know, ongoing, you know, character for me is King, and getting into the layers of the people in my novels is really the thing that, you know, fascinates me the most and drives the writing and the narrative.
Yeah. Well, you are known definitely for your characters, very believable characters. Sarah Michelle Gellar in the New York Magazine wrote, I love a good psychological thriller, and I like that Lisa's books have an underlying theme and pose a question that she argues both sides of. So what was the question in this book, Confessions on the 745, that you posed here?
Well, I mean, I think every character has his or her question, and you know, I think that it's sort of hard to talk about without giving anything away, but I think maybe the sort of overriding question in Confessions on the 745 is, you know, what makes us who we are, and how much choice do we have as we grow out of the circumstances into which we were born and start to create ourselves.
Right.
And that's a question that has come up again and again in a lot of my books, but there none so much as this one. And everybody in the book has this question at their heart, and you know, there's a lot of choices that each character has to make in order to define what her life will become in the aftermath of some pretty horrific events. So that, I would say, is probably the main question in this book.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, this book has received so many awards already. I just want to share a few of those with our listeners. I have a list of 11, but Instant Bestseller in Canada, Toronto Star Bestseller List, Indie Next Pick, Goodreads, The Big Mysteries and Thrillers of Fall, Glamour UK Best Book of 2020, Crime by the Book, Most Anticipated Fall 2020 Crime Fiction. I mean, the list goes on. So kudos on that. And then I guess my question I'm asking everybody right now, because we're in the middle of a pandemic and, you know, a lot of other issues in the world and in our country, how is this time affecting you as a writer? Are you finding, I'm hearing from a lot of people that they find they have less focus and less drive even, but I believe you're still based in Florida, right?
I am.
Yeah, so the situation there is being handled differently to how it's been handled on the West Coast, but have you found it's affected your productivity, your creativity in any way?
It's so interesting you should bring this up, because I have, you know, I've actually written about this, about creativity and chaos, and I do some speaking about it as well. For me, the page has always been an escape hatch. So even in the darkest moments in my life personally, you know, this has always been the place where I have gone to escape, right, to you know, sort of, to metabolize the chaos that I perceive in the world onto the page. And so that has been something that I have done since I was a child. And I'm also sort of an extreme introvert. So
you are
sort of the solitude and, you know, sort of lockdown and quarantine is, you know, isn't like so different from the way I normally live. Of course, I have to, you know, I'm a writer, so I'm home, I'm writing and stuff, and that's always been sort of my, you know, my kind of go-to place. And obviously, you know, it's difficult to, it's more difficult to get to that space, because there's a gauntlet that you have to run. There's always a gauntlet, like as a mom, as a person in the world, there's always a gauntlet that you have to run to get to that, like, sort of safe creative space. And now, like, when the world is essentially, you know, literally and figuratively on fire, and there's a constant influx of painful and sad and frightening news. And, you know, obviously the pandemic is a global event that's, you know, just impacted millions of people in, you know, all sorts of horrific ways. There's always an awareness of that. You know, there's always it's almost like a cloud or a weight that's always pressing down. And so, but as a writer, you know, as a creative, you know, I think that, you know, there's no place else in life or in the world where you will have more control than you do when you're at your own keyboard. And so I try to keep that writing space as like a sacred space. And no matter what kind of gauntlet I have to run to get there, I, you know, try to make the page my priority every day. And yeah. What that means is, you know, you try to get to it before the, you know, the onslaught of, you know, the news, social media, all that like toxic sludge that we're all wading through every single day, to try to get to it before you have to open yourself up to what else is going on in the world, and, you know, try to create what you can in a world that needs as much creativity and joy as you can put out there.
Yes, I think if you wrote a fictionalized version of what's happening when you look at everything, you know, social media wars, political behavior, traumatic world events, yeah. cultural chaos, people would say, oh boy, that's just not believable.
Exactly.
So
nobody would believe this.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, is there anything that you're taking notes on right now for a potential story or character, and are there subjects that you won't write about?
I mean, I always say, you know, I've always said there are things I won't write about, and then I feel like as soon as I say that I'm immediately writing about them, like just a
right.
kind of perverse like problem that I have. But I, you know, I feel like, you know, if you're living, if you're paying attention, if you're out in the world, if you're making, you know, if you're living an authentic life, that the world that you are experiencing will find its way onto the page at some point. You just don't know when. And that's kind of how I feel about this. You know, I'm taking in so much information all the time, and, you know, obviously there's all different layers of humanity that we're seeing for the first time, and all different kinds of, you know, just incredible events that we've never have imagined before. So it's surely impacting me in some tremendous way, and I'm sure that it will metabolize onto the page at some point in the future. I just never know when that will be.
Right. Well, I love that you dedicated Confessions on the 745 to your husband, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
You say, because after 20 years and counting, you're first, last, and always. I think that's lovely. Are you working on your next one right now, or are you not talking about it?
Well, I never talk about it, but I am working on it. It's actually done to the degree that it's in. I'm in the editorial phase on it now, so I'm working on edits, and, you know, that's for the 2021 book, and already thinking about, you know, what comes afterward.
Right. Well, Booklist calls this another brilliantly crafted psychological thriller. Publishers Weekly says diabolically clever. Unger just keeps getting better and better, which is, of course, your goal. And I know listeners can find out much more about you, Lisa, and your work at lisaunger.com. And, of course, the book we've talked about today is Confessions on the 745. Final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
You know, I think that, you know, just sort of stay hopeful, you know, stay positive, stay hopeful, keep looking towards the light. You know, I have great faith in, you know, in humanity, and, you know, I think we're evolving and changing and growing, and I think that things are, you know, I'm hopeful always that, you know, there's light on the horizon for everybody.
Super. Thank you so much, Lisa. Really appreciate you being with us. It's always good chatting with you. Always good.
So great talking to you, Vicky. Thank you.
And again, the website is lisaunger.com. And if you have questions, feedback, or comments on today's conversation, you can find me at conversationslive.net. You can also find our first interview with Lisa the same place, conversationslive.net. Just click on the search icon and type Lisa Unger into the search box. That will pop up. And you can find more than 700 podcasts at that same spot. So it isn't getting any easier out there right now, but I echo Lisa's thoughts. Keep hopeful. And until next week, be well, stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.